Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Since it is February and I know how cold it is in Minnesota, and luckily I'm in California right now, but for those who are in much cooler places, I know how home slippers are just game changers because they really help to keep your foot warm. However, there's a really big problem I have with slippers that you just kind of put your feet in and there's no strap on the back, because then without you knowing it, you are actually activating the bottom of your foot, which creates a very dysfunctional foot. We don't want to always be contracting and having to keep something on our foot. So having support in the back of the heel is super crucial. And guess what? Vivo Barefoot actually came out with a slipper that Dom and I both have and we love. And it's made from 100% wool. And it's actually made in partnership. And this is why we love Vivo Barefoot as well, is because they partner with other countries. And this one is partnered in Mongolia. So these are 100% made in Mongolia, and they're handmade from Mongolian craftswomen, where each pair is actually signed by their maker, which is really awesome. So not only are they going to keep you really warm, but they're also going to help to support your foot because they have that support on the back and they're barefoot. So you're still getting that sense of the ground, that work of that natural foot, as if you're walking around your house without anything on. So again, if you haven't checked out Vivo Barefoot yet, we have a special code only for our podcast listeners, and that's 15% off using code OPTIMAL. So go to the link in our show notes. You can just click on that link and it's going to automatically take you over. Or anytime you're just browsing the Vivo Barefoot site, don't forget to use code OPTIMAL at checkout. We've had a code change. So make sure you use code TOB so that you get 15% off. That is TOB, like the Optimal Body Podcast.
All right, I'm really looking forward to this next interview because we're bringing back on the podcast one of our great friends, Ben Carpenter, who has been a personal trainer for 17 years. He's an ex-fitness model and a bona fide research nerd. He actually also just came out with his new book, Everything Fat Loss. He's an international speaker and writer and has been featured in numerous publications, including Muscle and Fitness Hers, Bodybuilding.com, DailyMail.co.uk, and Insider.com. He dedicates his days to providing ample free education to the masses online, busting fitness myths, and relaying science to the general public in an easy-to-understand and often humorous manner. Ben literally is just a wealth of knowledge. We focus a lot of our conversation today on weight loss, the weight loss journey, and a little bit more specifically, fat loss. Get your notebooks ready because he goes through so much, and I know you're going to get a lot out of this interview.
You want to start it off, or you want me to start off?
You. You guys are boyfriends.
That's true. I think we already started. I think that needs to be in the cut. Do I have to look at you when we record?
He's going to turn around again.
I do make people's heart flutter. Don't worry.
that's the truth.
You're only human.
The truth.
Ben, thanks so much for being with us again. You are in a rarefied class because you are a second time interview and actually the only person we've done in-person interview with twice, so you should be very honored.
I feel very flattered to come on at all, let alone the sequel. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I mean, the work that you do online, which first of all, people need to go follow you on Instagram. We're going to have that linked up below because it's so very unique.
Favorite follow.
In how you deliver the information that is educational, research-based, but also entertaining.
You were going to say unique because it's educational, but also a bit sweary.
A little bit, yeah. So prepare yourself if you're not ready for that.
Very
on the
true.
Page. But what, why did you start going into social media and feeling the need to even start educating in that way? Because you've been a trainer for years now.
Yeah.
So why the need to kind of shift into that?
So I started as a quote-unquote gym assistant when I was 17 years old, which means gym cleaner. I was cleaning up people's sweat and taking bookings on the phone. And one day someone came up to me and said, can you help me build muscle? I don't know what foods have protein. And I was like, sure. And I just had a quick chat about what foods contain protein, what foods don't contain protein. And my manager came over to me afterwards and said, we're not paid extra for that, so don't bother. And I was like, oh, shit. And his kind of ambivalence towards helping people didn't vibe with me.
Yeah.
So I left, paid to become a personal trainer, started working with people one-on-one back in 2006. And after a few years, I was like, this is great because I really enjoy training people one-on-one. But it's also limited because if you only see up to 40 people a week or whatever, the amount of people I'm actually helping is quite small. So I started making free social media content. And if people asked questions, I would answer them and that was it. And that's all I've done since. I've been making social media content since, I think, 2009.
Oh my gosh.
Just because I kind of enjoy doing it. So it was born out of a desire to help people that I wouldn't be able to see in person. And I guess I just got a bit carried away and I never really stopped. I never did this with the goal of being like social media pseudo famous or kind of being a millionaire or anything. I was like, I just like helping people. And
yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's where a lot of it shines through is that, yes, you deliver it in a unique way. And it's funny because you say, I think I got a little carried away. And I'm like, well, I think you get carried away on most of your posts, which is the brilliance of it.
Yeah.
But it's like, you do it with such good intentions and such a genuine spirit of just wanting to help people. And I think that you have the perfect platform because you help really bust a lot of myths. I feel like that's what you dedicate, you know, a good number of your posts to, is busting myths on, you know, the junk that's out there on social media. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And do you feel, I don't know, like, it's the blessing and the curse of social media. I don't really know what my question is here, because you can deliver a lot more information to a lot more people. Like you said, you're relatively limited when you're working with people in person. But what would you say to the average person who's going to social media to seek out their health information?
So the kind of myth-busting angle that I have was never intentional. And actually, I don't like being too negative on social media. And sometimes my platform can seem a bit like that. But it's because I answer the questions that people send me.
Yeah.
So there is so much misinformation in the health and wellness space, and especially in the diet space, many companies fighting for your hard-earned dollar, that the number of, if I took all of the messages that people send me, most of them are, I need to explain why this is bullshit, rather than, yeah, this is great and here's why. So by default, it looks like I'm tackling misinformation more than saying, here's what you should do. And I think that's just reactive and representative of what a lot of the fitness industry is. But social media is hard to navigate. I think it's, if you took any industry that you're not familiar with, if you don't know about legal paperwork, for example, and someone says, can you read this contract? You're not expected to know if it's good, bad, indifferent, you don't know how to change it. So we probably shouldn't be surprised that people who are navigating the health and fitness space on social media don't know who to believe. I think that's normal.
I mean, and that's kind of, in a way, at least in Western culture in America, how we've been conditioned is like you find a problem and there's a quick solution that should come along with that problem to kind of fix it or cover it up or do whatever you need to for it, right? And so it's easy to grab on to messages that tell us something can be done in a certain number of weeks or 100%. With this one exact structure, this one exact plan, this one exact food. And that's where, you know, I think coming to your page and being able to be open to explore, okay, if like, well, it's not just carbs are the enemy, or it's not just this one way of being. And I think that's what's so fascinating. And it seems like you've gone a little bit more into like weight loss, fat loss, like why kind of stick in that niche of things?
Yeah. So I started with this because when I was working with people face to face, it was the most common goal.
Yeah.
Head and shoulders above everything else. So to begin with, when I was a fresh-faced, acne-ridden teenager kind of starting in the fitness industry, clients would come to me for all sorts. I want to run a marathon. I want to get a six-pack. I want to bench press X amount of weight. So I started very general. And then over time, when 8 out of 10 clients or whatever said, hey, I want to lose some body fat, it just made sense that I put more and more effort into researching that topic. And that just kind of spiraled. And as you both know, or probably know, I have a bit of an obsessive personality. And when I started getting into that, I just carried on and I kind of kept specializing, kept reading more. And that just became the thing that I was known for. It was never necessarily by design. I didn't necessarily pick it. It was just reactive to the questions I was asked. But as an example, in America, there's a very popular national survey that looks at things like dietary trends and what foods people eat and how much they exercise and stuff. And it's estimated that 50% of all American adults diet at least once a year.
Hmm.
So it's one of those things that it is always going to be a popular topic. People tend to weigh more than they did 50 years ago. More people are struggling to regulate their weight now than they were 50 years ago for many reasons. And diets have become so popular. And because diets are popular, it's made it a breeding ground for people selling misinformation. There's so many companies saying, you should try this diet, you should try these products, you should try this meal plan or whatever, that it's just become a minefield of misinformation, mm-hmm. I think.
And I mean, that's a fascinating point, that the average American diets
yeah.
at least once a year, wherein I think is the issue, is yeah. like a diet shouldn't be a thing with a set start and end point. And yeah. I think that's one of the misconceptions that I've always struggled with, is like people ask like, well, don't you ever diet, or what's your diet? Or like, I see, and I've kind of tried to mold in my mind, a diet as a lifelong thing. Like our diet should be something that we view over a lifetime that might ebb and flow, but shouldn't be a 30-day whatever, shouldn't be a 30-day detox. You know, it should be something that has longevity to it. So other than that, the concept of diving into a diet that might not be sustainable, where do you feel like most people go wrong when they start the fat loss journey or the weight loss journey, especially being early in the year? I feel like a lot of people are starting New Year's resolutions to do whatever, to lose weight, to look a different way, to work out more.
Or might have already fallen off their goal.
Fallen off the wagon.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's a really good way to describe it, and also quite illuminating for how a lot of people view it, is the quote, falling off the wagon.
Yeah.
Because it implies they've jumped on a wagon to begin with. And if you took 1,000 people, and you said, okay, these are 1,000 people who are actively trying to lose weight, seeking intentional weight loss, starting January the 1st or 2nd or 3rd or whatever. Chances are, most of them are going to pick something that's very different to what they were doing already. They will sign up to possibly a drastically different plan, whether it's low carb or intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding or whatever. They will often sign up to something that they may have been sold the benefits on, but it will often be a very big overhaul and a big switch where they change everything they're doing to go on this diet. And after a certain period of time, the diet becomes less fun, weight loss slows down, and they fall off the wagon and go back to how they were doing before. So dietary interventions, like weight loss dietary interventions in research literature, tend to be, let's say, a few months on average. So whether a diet is best or not over a period of a few months is interesting to know, but ultimately, most people don't want to lose weight for 6 months and then go back to what they were doing before. And we need a big paradigm shift where people stop searching for the quote-unquote best diet to do on January the 1st and think about what they can do to help their nutrition habits, their exercise habits, so they can do something they sustain. And I would describe it as, if you were working with patients, let's say 1,000 patients for the same number came to you with back pain, you wouldn't say, here is your back pain plan to everyone. Everyone has a different reason. Some of them you might know, some of them you might not know, but you work with the person to try and improve their circumstances. But in the dietary world, it's not like that. It's like, here is your low carb diet, here's your intermittent fasting diet, your Mediterranean diet, your paleo diet, or whatever. People try it. Some people get results, some people don't, some people hate it, and they feel like they go backwards. But ultimately, they're adopting something that is often very different and very radical to what they were doing before. And after a while, it becomes less appealing, Mm-hmm. And they're like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I think an easy way to describe it is people want results that last years, but diets are being sold as habits that they can only maintain for weeks.
Mm.
No one ever starts a juice cleanse in January thinking, I'm still going to be doing this in December.
Yeah.
But if they're not still doing it in December, do they know why they're only doing it in January? Mm-hmm. Do they even know how to focus on improving lifestyle behaviors in a way that's sustainable?
So does diet really even matter then when it comes to fat loss? Does this like eating a specific diet a specific way matter?
Good question. The short answer, yes. The long answer, probably not as much as people think. Mm-hmm. So obviously you can change your diet and get, and lose weight, build muscle, whatever. Your body composition is like a consequence of your behaviors. And if you eat more food or you eat less food or if you eat more protein or whatever, you can influence your body composition. So from that perspective, diet obviously matters. Now, the bit that people trip over on is when you look at long-term results, not the course of a few weeks or a few months, when you look at 1 year, 2 year onwards, mm-hmm. named diet differences result in trivial body composition differences between each one.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at like review papers that look at, say, a dozen different diets or however many diets, the actual weight loss results long-term between them, there's almost no significant difference. And primarily, that is because most of them have really underwhelming results by year one and year two.
Mm.
And a lot of these are, if I say to you right now, okay, here's your diet plan, kick you out the door, good luck.
Yeah.
Everyone would lose weight to begin with. After a while, they're like, this doesn't vibe with me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They start slowly losing adherence. Their diet starts getting a bit more lax. The same way someone that comes to you and you give them mobility exercises or strengthening exercises, they start great to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, they do them less and less frequently. Perhaps their results start going back towards baseline. The same type of thing happens in the dietary intervention world. So all diets work, assuming it involves changing the number of calories you're consuming, the amount of protein you're consuming or whatever. But when you pan out over the long term, it doesn't seem to make much difference because ultimately, when you look at large groups of people, no one sticks with diets long enough for them to do anything in the long term anyway. So what is a better solution is finding out the habits that you want to change and you want to adhere to and finding a way to make that work.
Mm.
Finding ways to reduce your calorie intake or consuming more fruits and vegetables or consuming more protein or any dietary behaviors that we know can help improve health or body composition in the long term, and focus on adopting those in a way that people can actually sustain.
Mm.
I've also heard, you know, different people make claims on things like food journaling, mm-hmm. and how food journaling can act initially as a very successful, you know, tool to start becoming more aware of the foods you're putting in, and actually, you know, end up helping you lose weight in the long run.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think about things like food journaling, or I guess to tag along with that, and I know they're likely very different, but tracking calories and macros along 100%. With that, which some people might do in a food journal scenario.
Yeah, so this is described in research literature as self-monitoring. People are recording what they're eating, whether it's foods, food types, calorie contents, macronutrient contents, meal frequency, whatever. It's recording down what they're consuming. And in weight loss literature, self-monitoring as a whole has been described repeatedly as a cornerstone of weight loss treatment. And primarily it is, there are multiple reasons, but primarily people are able to monitor and change what they're doing according to the results. So monitoring your calorie intake is a little bit like monitoring your expenses as a business. If you're looking at your expenses, you're looking at your income, you can decide where you can fine-tune things. So you might go, oh, we're spending too much money on shipping this month. Calorie budgeting and self-monitoring and food journaling is that type of thing. People can write it down very crudely, food diaries, yeah. and people are like, oh, I didn't realize I drank this much alcohol, or I didn't realize I ate this many fast food takeaways. And it can be eye-opening just to write things down like a journal.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to get more meticulous where they're doing things like calorie tracking or macronutrient tracking or anything like that, it all stems and it all falls under the same family, But ultimately, it's just monitoring what you're doing so you can adjust it. And in weight loss literature, it is almost unanimously described as an important behavior or a useful behavior if people want to lose weight. Now, the flip side of that is it's not always very fun. Mm-hmm. And most people who do it don't want to do it forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there can be some useful reasons to do it to begin with. So you can do it almost like a dietary audit. If you wrote down everything you ate and drank for 3 days, you might go, oh shit, I didn't realize I eat zero vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't realize that I'm eating this much fast food or whatever. But ultimately, it's from a place of awareness. You can use it as a tool when the tool is necessary. You don't have to do it forever. You don't have to do it at all. It's useful for some people and it might not be useful for other people.
To be honest, that kind of mirrors for me journaling for emotional reasons. I feel like people will do the same thing, journal about what happened during the day, how they felt, and it allows them to reflect on, you know, why they might feel a certain way. Same thing with the food. It builds awareness, and it kind of reminds me, I think there was one time in my life that I've kept a detailed food diary, and it was part of a nutrition course when I was in college on like MyPlate. I don't know if you've heard of the MyPlate platform, and it was just like a week straight. And yeah, you notice. So on the days I ate two bananas as a part of a meal, like my potassium levels were through the roof, and you start to associate certain foods with achieving daily recommended values in certain nutrients and stuff like that. So
yeah, food journaling can be good. Just from that perspective of bringing awareness, it can be super informal, just like that. And you're like, oh, it's good. I've noticed that I am eating this, or I'm not eating enough of this, or whatever. And often you can do it for a short period, and that can set you up for sensible behaviors in the long term.
You've still got the information.
yeah, exactly.
And then when, you know, we hear a lot of, or at least what I see on social media, and one of the things that I feel like is most combative or talked about a lot is calories in, calories out.
Yeah.
There's the camp of like, this is all you need to do.
Yeah.
You just need to consume less calories or work out more.
Yeah.
And then there's the other flip side who says, no, you don't even need a calorie count.
Yeah.
Like that's BS. You just need to check your hormones or whatever it may be, you know? So it's like, what are we listening to? What really matters when it comes to weight loss and fat loss in particular? And where do we land in between these groups of people?
So two people, I think sometimes on social media, two people can say things that sound completely opposite, but they're often just arguing past each other.
Yeah.
So if you look at weight loss literature where they give very specific amounts of food to people and they do things meticulously, people who consume fewer calories relative to how many they burn, a calorie deficit or negative energy balance, lose weight in the long term, irrespective of dietary methodology, whether it's low carb, low fat, Mediterranean diet, paleo diet, etc. Interventions where people reduce their calorie intake in the long term will result in weight loss and fat loss. And it gets a bit more confusing than that because fat loss and weight loss don't always
hold.
Yeah, exactly. But generally speaking, that is something that is very hard to argue against when you look at a lot of research trials. So from that perspective, as long as you're in a calorie deficit, it doesn't matter. So calories are the thing that matters. It is a fundamental law of physics, thermodynamics. Are you consuming fewer calories than you burn, you'll lose weight. Now, the bit that makes things a bit more complicated is food quality and food quantity are kind of intertwined, because if you told people to only eat certain foods or only eat at certain times of the day, you can influence their calorie intake and calorie expenditure without them ever tracking calories. So a good example of this is say a ketogenic diet, a very low carb diet. If you tell people to go on a ketogenic diet, more often than not, they will reduce their calorie intake straight away. Sometimes it's good from an appetite regulation perspective. Sometimes it's good because they're consuming more protein. Consuming more protein and reducing carb intake can sometimes lead to changes in total body water and glycogen, which can result in immediate weight loss. But generally speaking, it's food quality that then influences the number of calories you're consuming.
Yeah.
So I could say to a group of clients, from this point onwards, I want you to consume more protein, consume more fruits, more vegetables. I want your grains to be unprocessed, high fiber, because they're better for appetite regulation. And I want to make sure that you're consuming enough water and liquids, which again help appetite regulation. And these behaviors can influence people to reduce their calorie intake without them ever calorie tracking.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some people that say calorie tracking is useless and calories don't matter because if you focus on food quantity, it's irrelevant. But all of these things are intertwined. And I feel like you say, there are two band camps arguing with each other. Whereas in reality, sometimes they're not even arguing about the same point.
Right.
So if you change food quality, it will inadvertently influence the amount of food you eat and the number of calories you burn. Two people can consume 2,000 calories per day, but if one of them is high protein and one is low protein, the one who is eating a higher protein diet will burn slightly more calories than the one who's eating a low protein diet. That doesn't mean that calories don't matter. It just means that the factors that influence calorie balance are complicated.
And within that, there's so many other factors about, you know, what is it, the thermogenic effect of food.
Right.
Where if you're eating higher quality food, generally it takes your body more energy just to burn and process that food anyway.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that ends up playing into, oh, if you eat higher quality food, your baseline metabolism essentially is getting raised a little bit as well.
Yeah.
To play at that calorie balance where...
I think that's one of the things that becomes really confusing for people is because if you take two identical twins, both of them eat exactly the same number of calories, but one of them consumes more protein, one of them consumes more unprocessed foods, which tend to require a little bit more energy to break down and utilize than ultra-processed foods, perhaps. Even though they're both consuming 2,000 calories,
yeah,
the thermic effect of food, or something called diet-induced thermogenesis, can be higher on the high-protein, unprocessed food diet. So even though they're both consuming 2,000 calories, it doesn't mean they're in the same calorie balance or energy deficit.
Yeah.
And your diet changes every day. The number of calories you burn changes every day. Even if you're consuming the same number of calories every day, the types of foods you eat influence calorie burn. So I think people get too hung up on, if you consume 2,000 calories a day, that's your goal.
Yeah.
Because what you eat matters as well. Yeah. And I think people have become so enamored with the fact that calorie balance is a fundamental that sometimes they overlook the role that food quality plays within that. And they're intertwined and they're dynamic.
And then I feel like that's where that diet talk comes into play again of, well, okay, I'm trying to eat more protein and unprocessed food.
Yeah.
But for my long-term mental health too, and not, you know, demonizing foods, like where do I then play the balance of the long-term game of being able to eat unprocessed foods and have the cookies and the cakes and, you know, and still be on this journey. So how does that play a role? How do we balance that in?
It's the old good food, bad food conversation.
Right. Yeah. So again, this is one of those topics I think people argue past each other and maybe don't understand the point of the argument that they're going up against. So generally speaking, we know that some foods are more health promoting, whether it's nutrient dense or sometimes less energy dense. Like if someone's eating a lot of ultra processed foods, fast food takeaways that are high in refined fat, refined sugar, refined carbohydrates, we know that a diet high in those is likely to be worse for health, mm-hmm. obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So from a dietary perspective, it's very easy to say, okay, all of those foods are bad. Don't eat those foods. Don't eat any ultra-processed foods. Everything you eat should be unprocessed and you'll be fine. Now, the bit that's difficult to reconcile is when you tell a group of people that they cannot eat certain foods, psychology is complicated. And abandoning those foods forever is something that most people cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an unfortunate and inconvenient truth. But imagine... in your head, if you're listening to this, imagine the food that you think you love that most people would say you shouldn't eat a lot of that. Imagine someone comes along and says, okay, from this point onwards, what's yours? What's your example?
What Madagascar food? Vanilla bean ice cream.
Oh, every night.
Okay.
Gelato. Yeah.
So everyone who's
listening... Every night? Don't tell them. Every night? God.
So everyone who's listening to this will be like, we know that ice cream isn't great from a fat loss perspective, but imagine as your personal trainer, I came along and said, okay, from now on, you can never eat ice cream. How long would you do it for realistically?
Before I end up face down in the pool?
Yeah.
A week and a half.
And this is the thing that this is the balance that people need to reconcile.
And then I go get myself a half gallon of that stuff and yes. take it down in one night.
Yeah, so there's a concept known as dichotomous thinking, which is you break foods down into, I can eat this, I can't eat mm-hmm. this. This food is good, this food is bad. But when you do that, it can often force a level of dietary restriction that is not feasible for people to maintain. Yeah. And you know, and I know, and everyone knows, that if this world did not contain ice cream, and your temptation for ice cream vanished because it didn't exist, you are likely to possibly lose a couple of pounds of whatever the ice cream does to you long term. But ice cream does exist, and it's here. And unless you think you can avoid it for the rest of your life without the mental stress of doing it, without the emotional stress of avoiding foods that other people are eating around you,
yeah.
you have to somehow find a way to still enjoy those foods in moderation. And some people find it very easy to say, okay, I'll never eat ice cream again.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would prefer to say, actually, this ice cream is delicious and I love eating it with my wife when we're watching Netflix, or I love eating it with my kids, or whatever it is. And that balance is different for everyone. And mm-hmm. I don't think there's an easy solution to this. It's just working out where on the spectrum you fit between this diet is health promoting and, oh my God, I can't stick to this diet because it's so ridiculously restrictive. Because if people go on a diet that's so restrictive they can't stick with it, we go back to the example you gave at the beginning where people go on the bandwagon and after a while they fall off the wagon.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. if you can't avoid ice cream forever, your diet says no ice cream. If you can only do that for 2 weeks, you've jumped on a wagon knowing that in 2 weeks you're going to fall off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I think what people need to realize too, like, yes, we say that with Tom, it's almost every night, but you should see the amount
of greens
that he has throughout the day and the amount of vegetables. Like, he takes in way more vegetables than I take in. And like the...
Now you're trying to butter me up because you...
No, just the amount of great unprocessed food. Like, yeah. I think that's where... It becomes this different where it's not just about the ice cream anymore. It's 100%. That he's adding so much other stuff in throughout the day and it doesn't leave as much room for unprocessed stuff. So when he has it every once in a while, like it's not a deal at all.
Yeah.
And just the way he moves his body throughout the day and all that kind of stuff.
And I don't sit there feeling like, oh, this is bad. I'm eating a cup of ice cream. Like, I enjoy it. It's a great food, it's a great treat, and I really enjoy to eat it. So yeah, I tried years ago to start breaking down those good and bad food arguments, because I also know that there's a concept of when someone goes on something very restrictive like that, or is taking part in a time-limited, very restrictive diet, there's kind of that rebound effect where, like, I don't know if you can talk to that at all or have any specific examples of where, oh yeah, you may lose a few pounds, but actually 6 months down the road, we find that you have gained that all back.
Yeah, so there are different kind of biological and psychological drivers for this. The psychological one is something known as counter-regulatory eating. So hypothetically, let's say you go on a diet and you stop eating ice cream. If in 2 weeks' time, Jen brings back the most delicious looking tub of ice cream, it's your favorite and it's bigger than normal. You've avoided ice cream for so long that when you start eating it, some people will notice they eat more than they used to. And counter-regulatory eating is like, imagine that you have given yourself a set of dietary rules, but then when you break those rules, you break them above and beyond what you would have done mm-hmm. before. So it's kind of like the restriction can backfire. So there are some early research studies where typically if you give people food, they will then eat less. If you give people a bigger lunch, they will eat a smaller dinner because their appetite levels out. This is like mm-hmm. dietary compensation. For people who have a high degree of dietary restraint, i.e. they're dieting, they're trying to avoid foods, they're restricting themselves, what they will sometimes notice is when they start eating something, they then eventually eat more food than people who weren't restrained. And this is part of the reason why avoiding things can sometimes backfire from a psychological perspective. From an appetite perspective, in the long term, if people lose weight, there is also the possibility that in the long term, their appetite levels will increase. Mm. So it can biologically feel harder to keep losing weight if you have lost a significant amount of weight already. So for example, there was one research study where they put people into a really gentle energy deficit without them realizing it. And they estimated, mathematically, they calculated their intake and their expenditure, They estimated that for every kilogram of weight they lost, their appetite went up by about 100 calories per day. So if people lose a significant amount of weight, their appetite will slowly start creeping up and their body will almost fight to regain the weight or to stop losing weight.
Yeah.
And some people might say this is just a kind of famine response. You can't keep losing weight forever because you would die. So your body will try and stabilize that. But some people find that this, let's say, quote unquote, set point, which is a bit debated, but let's say set point, is higher for some people where they find it harder to get to a certain point. So I find it far easier to be leaner and have a low body fat percentage than probably 99.99% of the population. Doesn't necessarily mean that I'm working harder. It's just easier for my body to regulate where it is than it is for other people.
And I think that's what's most frustrating for people to especially scroll through social media. And we do, you know, associate fat loss, weight loss with aesthetics.
Yeah.
And what it's supposed to look like rather than what it might feel like within my body. And
100%.
And I do you find that's hard too? Because we can look at you and be like, you're so cut, fit, like no body fat. How do you kind of preach the message of, you know, finding this weight loss journey or this fat loss journey for what that means within your own body without comparing it to the aesthetics of what you see on social media or what it's supposed to be in the media everywhere?
Yeah. So there's some interesting research that suggests that people who are subject to westernized media, celebrity culture, glossy magazines, highly airbrushed images, tend to have worse body image, worse perceptions of body image and self-esteem. So, for example, if you're browsing social media and you're looking at loads of fitness models with shredded six packs or professional athletes all posting incredible photos of their physique looking really lean, really muscular, whatever, often highly airbrushed or edited or whatever, side topic, but that can have a detrimental impact on people's mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that I think is really important for people to understand, and this is something that I kind of came to the game late on, is for a lot of fitness people, seeing very low levels of body fat and equating that with health can be really problematic, because people who are in fitness magazines, bodybuilders who are on stage, people who are at their leanest, for a lot of them, feel terrible. And I know this because I've done it. I've had photos in magazines, I've dieted for that level of body fat. And I didn't realize how terrible you can feel at that point until you get there and then you kind of step out of it. And you can equate this with all sports to a degree, I think. Any sport that requires a degree of leanness, there will probably be examples of people in that sport that tell you they feel terrible. Gymnastics, ballerinas, swimmers, anyone who's dieting as part of their sport and maintaining a low level of body fat as part of their sport, there will be someone in that class that will say, I pushed it too far. My body felt worse. I was feeling more hungry. My psychology started deteriorating. My mental health started deteriorating. I started to get more injuries, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that same thing happens within the fitness realm. But within the fitness realm, we evaluate people exclusively on how they look.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a ballerina or a swimmer or a gymnast or whatever, you watch them and their physique is visual, obviously, but you're also watching their skill.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you see a photo of a fitness model in a magazine, you're looking at their aesthetics only. And it becomes almost like a race to the bottom, and the bottom is the lowest body fat percentage. But the problem is the lowest body fat percentage isn't the highest state of health.
Yeah.
And I could give a million examples of people I know who have incredibly lean physiques, who if you talk to them about their health, would openly admit that they are not a role model. A lot of drug use, high rates of eating disorders in fitness culture, whatever it is, a lot of people feel worse when they get leaner and leaner.
Mm-hmm.
But the leaner physiques are the ones that we often celebrate. Mm. And that becomes an issue because especially teenagers and people that are looking up to physiques they see in magazines, they can aspire to look like someone who might feel like shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized this myself later on. So I got to that point. I actually remember it quite vividly. This must have been maybe 6-7 years ago. I used to like dieting for photo shoots, and I like doing the whole kind of fitness model thing. And I remember one day a guy messaged me and said, "How do you get your physique? You are physique goals." And I was like, "No, no." Like, I realized that that is the message that I'm reinforcing. People were looking at my photo saying, "I want to look like that guy." And I didn't want that. I didn't want people to look at my physique and think that is the thing I should be emulating, because I felt terrible at the time.
Mm.
I felt much healthier when I weighed a few pounds more, or maybe 10 pounds more. But people were looking at the lean photo and going, "That's what I want to look like." And over time, I made a very conscious decision to minimize the amount of the number of photos of me on social media and make it just about other people. Make videos for people, make educational content, rather than posting professional photo after professional photo after professional photo, because it's great for the algorithm. It's impressive. It's kind of like the equivalent of fitness porn voyeurism.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you're looking for, like, oh, like you're scrolling, like, who's got this physique?
Yeah.
That type of thing. And it's just, I don't think it's healthy for people to only be looking at those type of images without realizing the sacrifices that are involved.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I give you immense credit for, you know, having the physique that you do have, but I've never seen you, you know, intentionally post pictures like that to take advantage of an algorithm. You want to do it from a genuine place of education and getting people the right message anyway. But everything being what you just said, do you feel that it's okay for people to have physique-based or body image-based goals when it comes to dieting or losing weight? Or do you think that's energy better spent in learning more about what optimal health means?
Great question.
You know?
Great question. So I'll approach this from two different directions and then let people come to their own conclusions. So losing weight for some people can improve their health. Losing weight past a certain point can also cause detriments to people's health. It's obviously like an individual basis. Some people will say, because of that, you should diet, you should improve your health, especially if someone is with a higher body fat percentage to begin with. You should diet because it's good for your health, you might live longer, etc. Now, the flip side to that is you can also improve your health without dieting. Take that person with a higher body fat percentage. A lot of people will feel like they've gone diet after diet after diet, yo-yoing in, yo-yoing out, never finding something that sticks. And from a sustainability and health perspective in the long term, that probably isn't ideal either. So it might be better for that person to shift away from going in and out of dietary phases and trying to work on healthy, sustainable behaviors. Now, from a mental health perspective, I think everyone is free to do whatever they want with their body, their life, their rules. One of the kind of counter arguments towards dieting in general is becoming so physique obsessed that it can be detrimental for your mental health. Yeah. So one easy talking point example is, if I wanted everyone listening to this podcast to weigh less, I would say weigh yourself every single day.
Mm.
And if your weight starts going up, eat less.
Mm.
And that is a scientifically valid method of helping people with weight control. Now, what percentage of those people will start getting worse mental health?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a subset. There's a subset of people in research literature who weigh themselves every single day and notice that they have higher levels of anxiety and depression and lower levels of self-esteem. Now, that's not everyone. Some people feel better about weighing themselves when they do it regularly. But the point is, dieting for some people can cause psychological issues for whatever reason. It doesn't necessarily mean it happens to everyone. But I think it's a good idea to be cognizant of that, so you know how to navigate that personal minefield. So for some clients, I might say, don't weigh yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a bad road for you to go down at the moment. For other people, I've had clients who weighed themselves more regularly and said, I actually really like it, because I used to be petrified of standing on the scales. And over time, I have stopped fearing it.
Mm-hmm.
I have taken away the emotional attachment to it, and I look at it as objective data, and it no longer scares me like it used to. So it's not necessarily saying you should do this or you shouldn't do this. I think it's just a good idea to be aware and make decisions based on your own personal preferences from a place of education.
Which is the hardest thing, Ben, because everyone wants the one thing. Tell me what the one practice is in order to lose the weight, right? Like, that is That's the most difficult thing, and yes. especially in social media worlds where yes. people want that one fix, that one thing that works for me, that's going to work for everyone, that's going to just change my life.
Yeah, and this is a really difficult thing, and you will know this. Most people who make a lot of social media content will also realize this, but I know that you two are professionals and you have worked as a professional for years, and you've worked with people one-on-one, and you've worked in social media, in the context of social media. So if everyone, going back to the earlier analogy, comes to you and says, I want to help my back pain, you know that you treat people on a case-by-case basis. You identify the problems and you work on the problems if you think you can. But social media, imagine someone else pops up and they say, cure your back pain in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
How many people click on that because they're intrigued? It's something shiny. So your earlier approach, which is intellectually honest from a place of a well-meaning professional, which is come in, I will look at you, I will see what I can do to help. And then someone else pops up and says, I can cure everyone's back pain in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that get the attention.
100%.
And they're the ones that any logical person, when you stop and step back and think about it, will go, actually, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
If there are different reasons for people to have back pain, there can't be cure your back pain in 2 weeks for everyone. It might work for some people. It might not work for some people. It might cause more pain for other people. But those are the equivalent of the newspaper headlines that attract people to click on.
Yeah. And those are the people that are succeeding hand over dollar holding fist yeah. in online marketing, because they have the catchy, you know, one-liners, they have the catchy ads that can tell you you can solve all your problems in a couple of weeks, and they make millions of dollars from it and leave a lot of people with a lot of unanswered questions at the end of those 2 weeks and potentially more issues than they started with. One topic that I want to just like briefly get your take on that we haven't talked a lot about, since we talked mostly about the dietary yeah. side of things. I mean, the other healthy behavior people like to focus on, especially when it comes to the weight loss journey, is mm-hmm. exercise. Mm-hmm. Movement.
Yeah.
And I know a very complex topic on how that plays into weight loss, but are there any gold nuggets or tidbits that you can give people when it comes to how to approach exercise when it comes to going in with the goal of slimming down or losing a few pounds?
Do you want the nuggets? Do you want the try this take home message? Because I can give you some if you would like.
Absolutely.
Okay, so when people exercise more, if you tell everyone to start exercising more, some people will feel hungrier without mm-hmm. realizing it.
Yeah.
And because of that, exercise on its own is not a reliable stimulus for weight loss. Some people, if they start marathon training, won't lose weight. Some people will. And there are just biological drivers that cause people to eat more food or less food. So generally speaking, it's very hard to say this form of exercise is best, because it doesn't work that simply.
Yeah.
We know from a health perspective that exercise is one of the most universally agreed upon things that can improve people's health. Same with avoiding smoking, not drinking too much. Mm-hmm. Exercising is good, and people know that. What I would say is, if you exercise solely to reduce weight, at some point you are going to be disheartened. Because everyone is going to stop losing weight at some point. Even successful dieters have to stop losing weight at some point. And so many people judge the effectiveness of their exercise regime on whether the scales go down. So what do they do when that external reward has been removed? One of the main reasons that people stop exercising is because they stop losing weight and they think this isn't working anymore. Yeah. So it's important to find motivators that are separate to how much you weigh. So both of you exercise a lot. You have found things that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. There are different modalities of exercise. There are different reasons that you like them. There are different reasons that you go back and you keep practicing to get better at it or whatever. But if you find something that you enjoy and try and make exercise second nature, then that is a habit that you know will be good for your health in the long term without that necessarily hinging solely on whether you lose weight or not.
So can we say, like, is there any research that determines one type or one form of of exercise, like cardio versus resistance training, or, you know, walking versus
HIIT exercises.
Yeah, you know, like, is it, are there certain types of movements in general that the research has found, you know, to be more beneficial when it comes to fat loss?
So resistance training is the modality of choice if you want to increase lean body mass, and that can also help fat loss. You don't necessarily change how much you weigh, but if you take a beginner who starts resistance training, chances are they will gain some lean body mass and reduce some fat mass, even if their weight stays the same. So from a fat loss perspective, resistance training can be great. From a weight loss perspective, aerobic training tends to have the slight edge because the calorie burn and the energy burn and the energy cost from aerobic training tends to be higher than resistance training. So if someone was solely trying to lose weight, not worrying about how much muscle they have or anything like that, doing a lot of cardio is probably going to be the smarter decision of the two. But with that, you have to factor in that the diet is always going to make the, when I say diet, I just mean what people eat, not necessarily reducing their food intake. Your nutrition and your diet is always going to be the main driver, because people who exercise more and eat more don't lose weight and don't lose body fat. There are some research trials where if you get people to exercise and do cardio 3 to 5 times per week, but you don't tell them what to do with their food, some people gain weight because they start ramping up their exercise and they naturally start eating more. So generally speaking, your nutrition is always going to be the number one driver of if your body weight changes. If you want to lose fat and build muscle, resistance training is great. If you want to, cardiovascular training is also great. And if you want to improve your health and improve your fitness levels, being stronger can help from a reduced mortality risk perspective, especially when people get older, sarcopenia, etc. Elderly people reducing their risk of falls if they're stronger, have more muscle tissue. But cardiovascular fitness is also good from a mortality perspective because it's a good proxy for health. So generally speaking, trying to improve your cardiovascular fitness levels, trying to get stronger, if you can find a modality of exercise that you enjoy that ticks both those boxes, you're away. And don't measure your progress based on how much you weigh, at least not in isolation.
So I think pickleball would probably do all of that for me.
Right? 100%. 100%. Pickleball, like, as a funny example, I hate cardio. If you said to me, go for a run, I would rather headbutt a wall repeatedly. It just, going for a run doesn't sit with me well psychologically. But as a kid, I always loved playing sports with balls. So if someone was playing football, soccer. If people were playing football, I couldn't see a ball and not run. So if you put a football in front of me, I will spend the next 2 hours running around because I enjoy the sport. But if you tell me to go for a run, I hate it. But I will run as soon as there's a ball there. So that's an example of how the intention and the psychology of the exercise can help get people from A to B finding a different vehicle.
Totally.
Yeah, I think that's a great example.
Well, and I think that just highlights, you know, I like how you highlighted the fact that it's not one or the other. You know, there's health benefits to both. It's what the intention is. And it's really, it has to come into that diet, lifestyle, nutrition as well. It can't just be like, this is the one form of exercise and this is why. And there is such a nuance between what people actually psychologically enjoy and will do more, because the reality is, I think in general, we don't move enough.
Yeah.
So telling people they have to strength train if they hate it, or they have to go run if they hate it, isn't going to be the thing that we're ultimately helping people to move more. So, you know, getting, just changing the language around it and the intention of what it's really doing, I think is most important. I think that's what you're helping to do.
Yeah. And that's actually something that is really well reflected in research literature as well. So generally speaking, we're less active now than we used to be.
Yeah.
And that's things like there are more transport options, more cars on the road, even less children walk to school, cycle to school than they used to because there are cars, buses,
sedentary job options.
Right. There's a lot more desk jobs, internet-based jobs. There's a lot more technology that keeps people sedentary. So whether it's games consoles, computer games, social media, a lot of things now encourage sedentary behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at people's activity levels overall as a population, they tend to be declining. And whilst it's great to have a 12-week study that says which of these types of training causes more fat loss, ultimately, that's only relevant if you love both of those types of training and you're genuinely tossing a coin which to pick. So if I said to people, running burns more calories than swimming, or vice versa, if everyone went out and said, okay, running is best, I have to run, or swimming is best, I have to swim,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like, but one of those options might have the slight edge on paper, but mm-hmm. ultimately, if people don't enjoy sticking to that, it was, I describe it as mental masturbation. They get too obsessed about the thing that's best on paper, and what's best on paper is totally irrelevant if people can't stick to it.
Mm-hmm. I think this is huge. And it just even reminds me, like, where I am right now, being pregnant and still showing up on social media, it's honestly freeing sometimes, because you expect me to have a bigger belly, you expect me to gain weight and to look a little different, and
yeah.
no one says anything about it. But I remember last year I posted after I ate and I was wearing really tight clothing, and I got multiple questions from people asking if I was pregnant. And I'm like, wow, rude. but you know, there's so much pressure in this aesthetic of what people expect and what you're supposed to do, where it's almost freeing being pregnant and being like, you expect me to gain weight and that's okay. And there's a freedom in that, you know? And I just wish that we could get back to the part of having that freedom for everyone to be able to say, you know, what am I really focusing on? What's my intention? What's my health goals, rather than what's my fat loss goals? It's a hard balance, I think, in this world.
I completely agree. And I think this is a great example of what can be quite a vicious cycle, because it's very easy to look at, and I won't name names, but it's very easy to look at celebrity culture and say the type of content that these people post can cause body image issues in teenagers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we can criticize the celebrities for the lots of airbrushing and the unrealistic beauty standards and the cosmetic surgery procedures behind the scenes. Valid conversation. But the flip side is, if you are someone that has a lot of eyes on you, you will be scrutinized more than other people. And it's very easy, for example, if I said to you, hey, you shouldn't post airbrushed images because this is causing skewed body image perceptions in your audience. But if you post an image that shows even a tiny little sliver of mm-hmm. cellulite, you will get people commenting.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact it's a totally normal phenomenon, you will be scrutinized so much that over time you're like, I feel like I need to post my best images.
Mm-hmm.
But where does that cycle break?
Exactly. And I think that's the hard part, but hopefully, and I also know people who are, you know, maybe looking the best, or what we might quote unquote, mm-hmm. you know, say that looks like, but they don't have their period, or they're not, you know, there's other hormonal issues that we know behind the scenes are going on. So it's like,
back to the conversation about aesthetics not equaling
exactly health. and being very conscious of what you're consuming and what you're feeling like you need to look like in order to be healthy, I think is so important. Well, anyways, you have a book. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yes. If you've been wondering why this British sounding man who used words like whilst
and football instead of soccer.
Yeah, football instead of soccer. If you're wondering why he sounds like an encyclopedia of everything, weight loss and fat loss, it's because he just came out with his first book, which is incredible, which is Everything Fat Loss, The Definitive No Bullshit Guide, which again, I love, because like you kind of said at the beginning, sometimes it seems like you get, quote, caught in these controversial topics, but on this podcast, I really appreciate how you answer a lot of those questions, because you really aren't controversial about it. You'll call a peach and you'll say where one thing might be beneficial, yet, you know, it might not work for some other people. And you'd like to point out all of the information. That being said, where can people get their hands on this book if they've enjoyed the different things that you've been saying today?
Yeah, thank you very much. I view it as a lot of people are trying to convince you that one method is best, buy my diet book, buy this diet book. And it's very difficult for people to understand how to make the best decisions for themselves. So my goal for the book, I describe it as giving people a menu of options. Here are the things that work. They might not work for these people. They might work really well for these people. But by giving the explanation, it's allowing people to pick and choose things based on their own personal circumstances. So rather than saying, you definitely need to try this diet, I'll say, here are the reasons that diet works. Here are the reasons you might not like it. Pick something that you think is best for you based on this level of education. And it's a very simple kind of goal to do that. Hence the no bullshit. I'm not trying to twist anyone's arms following my pretend revolutionary diet plan, which never existed.
I love it. And you really do. You do your research. Like, I see that all the time in terms of...
You sound so much more educated when we have a podcast like this than when we're just hanging out. You sound so much smarter.
No, but you really have taken the time to look into the things that other people do not want to look into. Like, yeah. I myself don't even want to look into research articles. Yeah, we have to because of our podcast, but like, we don't, it's not my favorite thing, and it's not many people's favorite thing, right? So you being able to distill it down in a book and being able to have this guide that can really help to guide people, I think that's what's needed in this time of one thing being one way and having, you know, this optimal formula, which doesn't really exist, as you said, you know, is so incredibly imperative. So I just, I'm so excited about it. And I hope other people get the book as well.
Thank you very much. That's very kind.
Absolutely love chatting with Ben and the opportunity we got to do that, because he is just a wealth of information, and his Instagram, truly, his book, I know, is going to be out of this world. So please go grab a copy. We're going to link it up below. You are going to want to get your hands on this encyclopedia of knowledge so you really feel empowered rather than just scrolling social media, trying to figure it out yourself. Ben has the answers. He's done the research. I really know he's done the work, and he just wants to bring credible information so that you have it available at your hands. So again, check out the link in the show notes and then pass this episode along to anyone you know who is struggling with fat loss or weight loss or needs this information as well.